from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we talk with the Marin Kani father and son whose story was featured in last year's film Beautiful Boy, all about drug abuse and how it can tear apart a family.
You think that you have this under control, and I understand how scared you are.
I understand why I do things. It doesn't make me any different, all right? I'm attracted to craziness.
That was Steve Carell and Timothée Chalamet as David and Nick Schiff in the 2018 film Beautiful Boy. And coming up on Forum, the chefs will join us to talk about the film and their new book for young adults, High, Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction. Join us after the news, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. David and Nick Schiff's father and son memoirs about dealing with drug addiction inspired last year's film Beautiful Boy, starring Steve Carell. And now they want to shift the conversation about drugs from the old slogan, just say no, to just say no, K-N-O-W. Their new book, High, Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction, is a resource guide for young readers from 5th to 8th grade. And David Schiff, who's based in Marin County, and Nick Schiff, who grew up there, join us to discuss how to encourage conversations about addiction and its consequences. And I want to welcome first David Schiff, journalist and co-author. Welcome to the program.
Michael, thanks so much.
It's been years, and you have gone on to, be featured in a film with your son. How's that all happened? What was the effect about it? Talk about it.
Weird. weird to go to a movie theater and see Steve
your
Carell.
Story.
Yeah. Yeah, our story, Steve Carell, Timothée Chalamet playing my son. But the cool thing has been, it just, the power of movies, how many people it reaches. We've heard from so many people. And at a time when, the drug crisis in America, addiction, overdose, 200 people dying every day, people go to the movie and feel just their experience affirmed. And I hear from them over and over again. It's, it's been amazing. People feel catharsis. People have reconciled within families. Kids have gone into treatment because of the movie.
Oh, it's very heartening. And it's also, when you think about the numbers, it's pretty shocking. More opioid overdoses than deaths by cars or guns. That alone stands out and is really extraordinary. Let's hear a cut from the film.
You think that you have this under control. And I understand how scared you are.
I understand why I do things. It doesn't make me any different, all right? I'm attracted to craziness, and you're just embarrassed because I was like, I was like this amazing thing, like your special creation or something. And you don't like who I am now.
Yeah, who are you, Nick?
This is me, Dad. Here, this is who I am.
Poignant and real.
I
don't like much in Hollywood, really.
No, scarily real, actually. And, it's a movie. There's a lot of creative license taken. But, the heart and soul of what it's like to live with a child who's addicted is right there. And it's very painful.
You went through hell. And so did your son. And we'll talk with him in a moment as well. But I think, something that nobody can understand unless they've been through it.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think that, God forbid any child is ill, parents suffer immeasurably. But when it's addiction, it's different. It's different because of the way that we as a culture look at addiction and drug use. There's this moral lens. There's this shame. There's this guilt. So it's not about openness. It's not about getting support. It's often about, hiding until, in our case, it was, we hid. I pretended it wasn't happening until I couldn't anymore because things got so bad. And Nick was so close to dying that there was no more. It was just impossible to pretend it wasn't happening.
Not only so close to dying, but, everything took a secondary and tertiary and even beyond that to drugs. Everything.
Everything. Yeah. I didn't understand at the time. I was sort of like most of us probably, drug addiction doesn't look like a disease. It looks like a choice. It looked like he wanted to get high. He didn't care about anybody, care about, his mom, me, his stepmom, his little brother and sister. And only later did I realize that, somebody who's addicted, it's not about choice. Nobody wants to be addicted. The need for drugs is described by people who are addicted as like the need for oxygen.
There's also a difficulty semantically, and I've always kind of hemmed and hawed about this in my own mind, because when you talk about drugs as a disease, some people say, well, that's not me, that's my disease, and they kind of remove themselves from volition or free will by doing that.
Well, I think it's actually very different. It's the other, it's what it does is it explains something that is otherwise unexplainable. It makes no sense to see somebody who we know, you know, Nick was this lovely, moral, kind, you know, great person in every way, and all of a sudden he became someone else. And it was because that's what happened when people have, you know, brain diseases. That's what mental illness is. And that's why, you know, to me, nobody wants to be labeled in that way, of course, but it also explains it. It's like, oh, so on one hand, it's like, oh my God, my son is a drug addict. What does that mean? But on the other hand, it was sort of a relief to know this is not Nick. This is Nick's brain, in a different state, in a state of addiction.
And that brain, and let me go to you and welcome you first, Nick. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks, Michael.
Good to have you back on Forum. And Nick is now a writer for TV and movies, author of Tweak, Growing Up with Methamphetamines and We All Fall Down, Living with Addiction and Schizo, and writing kind of saved his life in many ways, too, I should mention. But, you know, you start out in this book with your dad, and this book is really an important book for young people to read because you want to give them choice, you want to give them knowledge and let them know what might be ahead if they make the choice to start on a pathway to drugs. And you're talking particularly to teens and tweens, fifth and eighth graders. But for you, it started with pot. And, you know, there was a time that we thought a pot is not a gateway drug. It doesn't really affect the brain that much. I mean, it's certainly true in the 60s when many of us were using cannabis. And yet you discovered many things that you really should have known about with respect to the effect of your brain and maybe even pot as a gateway drug.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is that the pot nowadays and when I was growing up too is, you know, infinitely stronger than the pot that was around in the 60s and 70s, because it's been so, you know, genetically engineered to be that way. But the other thing is that, you know, I think when you talk about addiction being a disease, I mean, the thing that I learned is that because of my particular brain chemistry, whenever I put a mind-altering substance into my body, it really doesn't matter what it is. As soon as that, you know, sort of the effect of the drug or the alcohol hits me, this phenomenon of craving starts, this obsession, and it becomes almost impossible for me to stop. And so that's the way that when I sort of talk about having the disease of addiction, that's what I think about is the fact that my brain processes drugs and alcohol in a way that is different from a normal person. And I do think if when I was younger, you know, when I first started smoking pot, I felt a very immediate sense of relief. I felt like it was sort of the answer to my problems. I'd been really anxious and insecure, and I felt uncomfortable around my peers, and pot kind of took that away from me. And I do think if I'd had the information to sort of know that that's a sign that potentially I might be someone that would develop a drug and alcohol dependency, I think that would have been useful to me. And I think it could have made a difference.
Well, you also talk about and write about in the book about it giving you temporary confidence, making you feel better initially. And you were scared. You had this whole inner life that really was turmoil. And you also found out later on that you were bipolar.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's another thing that I think is really important to sort of share is that most, not all, but a lot of us who have substance abuse disorder also have a sort of co-occurring mental health disorder. And, you know, I went to maybe three different treatment centers before I was actually psychologically tested, which is frustrating because I think that if I'd had that diagnosis earlier and I'd started on the medications for that disorder earlier, you know, I think it really could have helped me. So it just is so important with people who are struggling with addiction to make sure that they get the psychological testing that they need so that those underlying disorders can be identified.
Education, psychological testing, and keep coming back to those things, David Scheff, don't always work though.
They don't always work, but at least we know where to start. You know, it doesn't work. The whole shaming thing doesn't work. The blaming thing doesn't work. You know, the whole point
about... Just say no doesn't work.
Well, I was going to say, just say no. I mean, we all were subjected to, you know, DARE when we were kids. And, you know, a police officer came up and lectured us and told us that if you smoke pot, you're going to end up shooting heroin. And we knew that that was ridiculous. And we were probably high in the back room. So the whole point about, you know, it's ironic that Just Say No, K-N-O-W, is actually coined by Timothy Leary. Of all people, you know, and he's, of course, somebody who, as in many ways, was actually pushing drug use. But it's exactly what we need to know. I mean, kids are smart. if we exaggerate, if we lie, you know, they're going to know the truth. I mean, kids know kids who are smoking pot. So if we say, you know, if you smoke pot, you're going to be addicted, they know that it's not true of many of them, but they also need to know that it can be true. There's a whole list of things. You know, kids think that prescription pain pills are better than street drugs because, you know, they're made by a pharmaceutical company or something like that. But, you know, OxyContin and heroin are both opioids, and they're both killing people every day.
And you talk about nicotine as well. They think that vaping is somehow better than mm-hmm. but it's got nicotine in it, and it still has toxic effects and all of that. And as you point out also in the book, most kids are not drug addicts and are not necessarily using drugs.
Yeah, that's true. And the point also that's important, though, I think, is that there's a whole range the big thing is that, and the reason that it keeps coming up, you know, in an era of legalization, all this stuff, is that there's a lot of confusion that, you know, that because we're legalizing marijuana, then the returns are in and we've decided that marijuana is safe. And, you know, the truth is that there's a lot of research that shows that kids are not necessarily safe, and it doubles the chances that they're going to have a car accident, for instance. It does have an impact on the developing brain. I mean, whether it's going to lead to addiction of, you know, the scale, or, you know, the life-threatening addiction that, you know, that Nick suffered, that we suffered in our family was, you know, it's not the only outcome. There's a lot of, I mean, there are people who I visited treatment centers, people who say, oh, you can't get addicted to pot. I've visited treatment centers where the kids were all in their, you know, late teens, early 20s, and they never used any other drugs. And you don't go to treatment, and you don't go into rehab unless you've really done some damage to your life.
You say in the book, by the way, Nick, I'm going to go to you on this, you don't want to necessarily scare people, but there's scaring involved in this book. I mean, there are some frightening things because you take us into the depths that you went to and all of the difficulties you had. And it's a story that ultimately has hope attached to it. But you and your family went through hell, and it was a real family saga of hell. I'm also interested in finding out from you, though, just about the influence, because you write about this in the book, the influence of the movies and of music and so forth. It's very much a catalyst to drug use, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something that is, I mean, it's just to go back to what my dad was saying, too. You know, I think just because someone doesn't become addicted, it doesn't mean that drugs and alcohol can't have, you know, a severely negative impact on their lives. And to me, when I talk to young people, and this goes to your point, I think, is that, you know, there's something so kind of sad and even sort of pathetic that we're taught as young people that the only way that we can sort of socialize with each other and have fun with each other is if we put some sort of substance into our body, whether that's, you know, pot or alcohol. And that's definitely the message that we get from TV, from movies, from music. And, you know, I remember when I was a kid, my friends and I, like, we wouldn't hang out if we didn't have pot to smoke. And again, like, to me, there's something so much cooler about learning how to go to a party and have fun and not need drugs and alcohol as a kind of pacifier or buffer, and to sort of, I don't know, learn how to have relationships with each other without needing to sort of numb out with substances. I think there's something really strong about that. And I think that's a really sort of a hopeful message to sort of come out of what our country has been going through, is that it really is much cooler, I think, to not need those substances to sort of have fun. And for me, to be able to go to a party, to dance, to, you know, sing karaoke without needing to be, you know, drunk, I feel very proud of that, for sure.
There are some people who say they can't sing karaoke without being drunk. You know, that's a good excuse. But there's mixed messages in a lot of the films we see, and you write about this in the book. There's a kind of sense of being cool when you're using drugs, or maybe even that movies convey the idea that drugs are normal, all kinds of drugs, including alcohol, of course, which is a drug. And you have all these examples of Hunter Thompson and Ernest Hemingway and Charlie Sheen and Amy Winehouse, you know, people who try to, well, I'm just going to get wasted. You know, there seems to be, that's kind of a cool thing to just get wasted all the time and not to care about anything of what your messages are saying to the contrary, even in your own mind or even in your own heart. So you want to really, in many ways, send that message out and let young people know, yes, they can choose. But the choices should be smart, and they should be informed, and they should be based on really the information that's valid.
Yeah. And the other, I'm just going to interject really quickly, that the biggest point of the book, I think, is, yeah, a lot of it is about education. But a big piece of drug use is not about the conscious decision among for kids. A lot of it is, you know, the research proves it, but it also is true just because we know it's true that, you know, a lot of what we're doing is we're saying, let's not just look at drugs, let's look at why people use, why kids use. And it turns out that, you know, if you ask kids why they use, you know, we assume as adults they're going to say they use because it feels great, because their, you know, friends are using, peer pressure. But the number one reason that kids say that they use is because of stress.
Yeah, I found that in some ways very surprising, because you think about peer pressure as being the main reason, or being cool, or all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And yet, and it could also, I think the consequences of this we keep talking about, number one cause of crime, for example. I mean, it's overwhelming when you think of the consequences of the effect that it had on a family like yours and so forth. But the fact is that you can beat it. I mean, you know, you and Nick are living testimony to the fact that you can beat it. And it's hard work, a lot of rehabilitation, treatment, kind of access isn't there as much as it should be. And frankly, you got to be motivated. Let me ask Nick this question. I think the moment for you was a stolen computer with your mother, you know, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the moment for me, I guess, was beyond that. I mean, it's such a stupid story, but basically, to make a long story short, crystal meth makes you crazy and made me especially crazy. And so, you know, I had this brilliant idea that I was going to take apart my computer and I was going to take apart my cell phone and I was going to put them together and I was going to make this amazing supercomputer cell phone thing, which, you know, this was before the iPhone, so if I'd been successful, I, you know, could be Steve Jobs right now. But I was not successful, and so I had no computer and no cell phone, and so I decided to go steal a computer that I thought was in my mom's garage. And so I went with my girlfriend, and I dropped her off at the supermarket. I told her to wait there, and I went into my mom's garage, and I ended up having just like a total meth psychosis where I thought there were people outside and I was like hiding. And I was in there for such a long time. I guess it ended up being about 5 hours that my girlfriend, who was at the supermarket, ended up calling everyone. And she called my mom eventually. And my mom came and found me out in the garage with a member of the Los Angeles Police Department. And they gave me an ultimatum that, you know, either I go into detox or I go to jail. And they've done studies, actually, that they say it really doesn't matter why someone goes to treatment, whether it's voluntary or if they're coerced into treatment, the success rate is the same. I really did not want to go into treatment, but I also didn't want to go to jail, so I agreed. And there was a moment when I was in the detox that same girlfriend came to the treatment center, and you know, she said, "Hey, I figured out a way that you won't have to go to jail. If you come with me, we can hide out at my friend's house." And I remember just looking at her. And
didn't she also say there were a lot of drugs for the two of you, too?
Yes, yes. She had drugs in her car. And you know, she it was what I'd wanted to hear. I mean, everything up until that point was like, this is what I want. So I went to my room in the detox and I started packing up my stuff. And looking at her in that moment, it was just something that I can't explain happened, which is that I just knew that if I went with her, you know, she was going to die and I was going to die. And it wasn't going to be like some, you know, like you're saying, like some romantic Kurt Cobain death. It was going to be like real death, the end of everything death. And that reality just hit me so hard in that moment that I said, I can't go with you. I think you need to get treatment and I need to stay here. And it was kind of a miracle. I mean, the next day she went and she got into treatment and I stayed in the detox and then I went to a longer term treatment facility. And yeah, that was really the beginning for me of just being like, I can't do this on my own anymore. I don't know how to fight this thing. And it's just destroyed my life. Like, I'm willing to kind of do anything that people suggest to me.
Now, that was your existential moment. But what happened? Did she get clean, too?
She did. Yeah, she actually did. Yeah, I think somehow in that moment, it whatever hit me must have been enough to hit her, too, with the sort of the clarity of I don't know, it just...
What was she doing to the tiles? Can you remind me of
Oh, God. Well, that was actually more her thing. But again, you know, crystal meth is just such a dirty drug. But yeah, you know, she used to think that I was hiding drugs around the apartment, and so she would rip up all the tiles in the bathroom and you know, be convinced that she was finding drugs in there that weren't there. And it's funny, when I first did crystal meth, it was before Breaking Bad or any of these, you know, campaigns to sort of educate people about what that drug does. And I didn't even know what it was. Like, my friend offered me some speed in, you know, I think this was like in 2000 or 2001. And I did it, again, not even knowing that it was crystal meth. And the moment that I did that drug, I mean, that was really the thing that, first of all, it was like what I'd been looking for. I mean, it just felt like the answer to my problems. But it also, you know, once I started doing that, that was really when my life, you know, spiraled out of control.
It's been how long now, Nick, that you've been clean? I mean, you had a relapse. I know you had, you know, you fell back.
Yes, but no, it's been nine years, which is really miraculous.
No, that's, and congratulations on that. That's wonderful. But you probably look back and think, who the hell was that kid, huh? In part,
It's one of the kind of amazing things about the movie, actually, is because it has been so long, and, you know, like, you're, you know, I'm really involved in 12-step stuff, and I see a therapist, you know, twice a month, and I'm on, you know, psychiatric medication, and, you know, so I'm doing things on a daily basis to sort of make sure that I stay in recovery, and I'm, you know, sort of treating my disease. But at the same time, it has been a really long time, and so seeing the movie, it was just such an incredible reminder of, because it felt so real, you know, of what we'd gone through as a family, and how lucky I am to be alive, and how lucky I am that my family has made it through this, and we're all as close as we are today, and how lucky that we have this opportunity, my dad and I, to go around the country and talk to other people about these issues and connect with them, and, you know, and try to help in any way we can, because it's really, I mean, like you were mentioning the statistics, but, you know, over 200 people a day are dying from overdoses, and it's a crisis that we see in, you know, when we travel around the country with the you know, I mean, at every event we go to, there's at least 10 to 20 families who come who've lost loved ones.
Well, it is, as they say, a family disease. So often we're talking to Nick and David Sheff, and we're talking about addiction, and they have a book out called High: Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction. And I know there's much that you, our listeners, may want to know, or you may want to weigh in here. I know many of you who are listening have stories of your own, heartbreaking stories sometimes without a happy ending, like the Sheff story. But if you would like to join us, we invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We invite your calls. Again, the number to call is 866-733-6786. Also, join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and you can also, of course, post on our Facebook page, and we'll go to your calls and emails and postings in short order after we go to a quick break. But first, let me go back to David Sheff. Love is not necessarily the answer to this, is it? I mean, you loved your child, your ex-wife loved your child. It doesn't necessarily do it.
Yeah, well, love, you know, was a big part of it, and it is a big part of it, because, you know, any parent knows what that feels like. But, you know, when someone's sick, no, it's not enough. I mean, you talked about how Nick, you know, it's been 9 years, but there were 10 years. Nick's been clean 9 years, but there were 10 years when he almost died. And it was partly because the treatment system is a disaster. You know, if he had another disease, I would have known where to start. But here I didn't.
Well, we've been hitting on very important points, where to start, disease rehabilitation, detox, all the things that can help that aren't necessarily available to everybody, and all the importance that Nick's been emphasizing about education. We'll hear from you, our listeners, when we return. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We have father and son, David Sheff and Nick Sheff, here with us this hour. They're part of a movie that many of you may have seen called Beautiful Boy. I say they're part of it, but they're actually, it's their story, and a story about addiction, Nick's addiction, and really the hell that they went through, that the whole family went through, getting out of that hole of addiction. Getting some comments here that I think, the book that they've done, by the way, let me just say again, is called High: Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction. It's an attempt to kind of give a primer, especially young people who need the sort of education that Nick Sheff was talking about that he didn't have, and need information. And we're getting questions that really go right to the heart of the need for information here. Let me go to this first from Jessica, who writes, how do I talk to someone about seeking treatment when they do not want to go? My 31-year-old brother can't seem to get out of his own way and get treatment for meth. I have 5150'd him at SF General, and they let him go after 36 hours. I am scared and so frustrated. David?
Yeah, well, I've been there.
You've been there, done that.
And
that, yeah.
That feeling of being scared is, I mean, that's, you know, it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. And we have a different kind of ability to make decisions, or at least with our kids, our younger children. You know, we have more power to influence when it's a sibling and they're, you know, in their 30s, 40s, even, you know, 50s, whatever. I think that what we can do is make sure that people know that we love them, that we care, that we are there to support them. If they get help, when they get help, and we will help them to the best of our ability to get help. And, you know, a really important message, people think that it's hopeless, and it's not. I mean, you know, there are the tragedies that we...
But if they don't want to go for help, and Nick, let me go to you on this. You didn't want help, did you really, when you were in the midst of this, the throes of this addiction of yours?
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, I felt like I was on fire, and the only thing that had ever put out the fire was the drugs and alcohol. So to have someone take that away from me, it was terrifying. But, you know, I think, like I said, they have done studies that it really doesn't matter why someone goes into treatment, whether they're coerced or they go involuntarily, the success rates are the same. And that doesn't mean that it's easy. And, you know, I think it's such an important thing to remind people, you know, there's that whole thing on the airplane, like put your own oxygen mask before helping the other person. I mean, it's so important to take care of yourself first and make sure that you're safe and that your, you know, your family is getting the help that you need. And then, you know, to me, the thing that was most important that ultimately my dad did was, you know, he said he's not gonna, you know, give me money. He's not gonna, you know, bail me out. The one thing that he will do.
You're talking
do
about what they call tough love, basically?
Yes, but not shutting the door and not saying, you know, you have to figure it out on your own. He said, you know, if I was willing to get help and go into treatment, he would figure out a way to do that, whether that was helping me to get a scholarship program to a treatment center or to get into a county-run place. You know, he let me know that when I wanted help, that he would do what he could to help me get that help. And that message, I think, really did save my life.
Well, here's Julie, who writes, I was in an abusive relationship, part of which was my partner shooting me up with heroin when I got pregnant. Thanks to Planned Parenthood, I was connected with a program that got me on Suboxone. However, my daughter was in the hospital detoxing for 30 days after she was born. I struggle with how to talk to her about that. She is only 4, so I have time to figure it out. Do you have any suggestions? Should I even bring it up with her? This goes right to the heart of your book, David. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the truth is that, you know, one of the things that we've learned is that there are people who are much more likely to have drug problems than other people, and that there's a whole list of risk factors, and they include, you know, Nick had mental illness. They include people with mental illness, with learning disabilities, with eating disorders, kids who are growing up in poverty and dangerous, you know, environments, traumatized in any way. And one of them is that there is a genetic component to addiction. And so if you have addiction in your family, doesn't mean your child is going to become addicted, but they are at a higher, it's more likely. And so they need to know that. They need to know so that either, you know, they're able to navigate those years when there's so much pressure to use by not using, or if they do use, to just take stock and to notice if they respond differently to drugs than their friends. And hopefully once that door is open, once the door of communication is open between a parent and child, then, you know, I didn't know what was going on with Nick until it was pretty bad. In fact, it was catastrophic. But if you know you have the door open, you can have those conversations. And if a child, you know, will be open with you and say, you know, I am in situations where, you know, I've smoked some pot and it makes me feel different than it maybe feels with other people. And that's the time that a conversation can lead to whatever, therapy, just an openness, you know, figure if it's a severe problem, then treatment.
And the teen-tween years are really crucial, as you've said, directing your book toward that. I can tell you also, with my kids, I had to say, you know, I had to be honest with them. Yeah, I tried pot. I inhaled, unlike Bill Clinton and so forth. But the truth of the matter was that, as Nick said earlier, it's infinitely stronger now. And then there was Paraquat, and there were all kinds of things. And now we know things about the brain and so forth that we didn't know then. And everything's changed. Let me get some calls on here. Rob, you're first up. Join us, Rob.
Thank you. My wife and I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and this was a rite of passage. And, you know, it was just something that you did when you were in high school. And I think it's we're at a lucky time that we now know that hopefully that if you can prevent kids from trying it when their brains are still growing, that it will make it so that they're less likely to become lifelong addicts. We do have some addiction in our family, and we're at a stage with our 14-year-old where we're trying to keep him from going down that road. And his high school is very good at trying to explain the dangers of trying drugs and alcohol before your brain is finished developing. And we're just praying that we'll be able to navigate this stage in his life that's so important without having to test the waters with this. And just wondered if you have any other advice other than just trying to keep the lines of communication open, which we're doing, and just go with our gut, I guess.
So you have some more advice, Nick, for Rob that you want to offer?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right that the longer that someone you can keep your kids from using drugs and alcohol, the less likely they are to develop a dependency later on. So I think that is so important. And just the fact that you're having those conversations, that the school is facilitating that is amazing. Because, I mean, when I got caught smoking pot when I was in sixth grade, I think that, you know, the school just told my dad basically not to worry about it, that it was normal. So you guys are way ahead of where we were. But yeah, I mean, just being, you know, really, really open and honest, I think is exactly the right track, because you know, kids are really smart, they're really intuitive, and they get it, you know, and I think they can tell when people are not being honest with them. So I think everything you're doing sounds right on. I don't know, Dad, do you have any?
He wants to add something.
Well,
the
only thing I would add is this other piece of it, is that because once we know that kids are saying to us, you know, I use because it's of stress, then that gives us another way to help them grow up healthily, which is to really be paying attention. If a child is struggling in school, that's stressful. You know, cyberbullying, you know, bullying, worries about the future, you know, worries about stuff that's going on at home. I mean, the good thing about, you know, those are all risk factors, but the good thing about to know is that we can mitigate those risk factors by protective factors, which means that if a kid is struggling, we don't ignore it. We take them to help for help. If they are struggling in school, we get them support, and we can, if we can alleviate stress, then they're going to be less likely to use drugs in order to treat that stress.
With all this stress on stress, notwithstanding, and you've done the research on this and done your homework, and I respect that, I still think peer pressure is an enormous factor with so many young people.
Oh, it is. It is, and part of what we do.
They go to a party and they say, you know, here, pass around a joint. Why won't you smoke the joint? What's wrong with you?
Yeah. Well, one of the things we do there is a couple things. One of them is to say, you know, we do have a bunch of strategies. If you're in a situation like that, what can you do? And there are things that you can do to help your kids deal with the kinds of peer pressure that are going to happen. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's no simple answer. We all want a simple answer. It would be great if there was one thing that we could do, but we have to deal with peer pressure. We have to deal with these risk factors. We have to deal with, you mentioned, the influence of media. I mean, all that stuff, which is why we've got our work cut out for us.
Well, a question for you, Nick, from a listener named Ann, who says, do you think that there is really anything a parent can do or say that will prevent a child from taking drugs?
Yeah, I actually do. I mean, I it's not, you know, foolproof, of course. I wish that it was. But I think that if I had known and been given the information that you know, that is out there now, that I just didn't have access to, you know, I think it really would have made a difference to me. I mean, I now know, you know, my mom's dad drank himself to death, literally. I mean, she has alcoholism going back generations on her side of the family. And, you know, I didn't know that. I also didn't know that alcoholism was potentially something that could be passed down genetically. So, again, I think if I'd had that information, I'm not saying that it you know, would have been 100%, you know, saved us from going through this, but I do think I would have been able to recognize my own behavior and the feelings that I was having. And the other thing is, I just didn't think that if I asked for help, that there would be help out there. Like, I thought the way that I felt was just the way that I felt, and I was going to be sort of cursed to feel that way for the rest of my life. What I know now is that there are people working in every community, you know, tirelessly, who are have devoted their lives to helping young people to deal with those stresses and to deal with those feelings of not fitting in and of anxiety, and helping them to treat those feelings with things other than drugs and alcohol. So, Yeah, I wish I'd known all that stuff. I think it would have made a difference.
We're talking with Nick Sheff and David Sheff, co-authors of a book called High, Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction. And here's a caller from New York City. Jazzy, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi there. Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you for having this discussion. It's really appreciated. I have a question about cultural barriers with recovery, in terms of addiction, of course, and in a lot of cultures, recovery and mental illness in general just aren't acknowledged. And if someone is in a state of addiction or whatever it is, they don't necessarily have someone to pull them out. And I just was interested in knowing resources for that and if there are any.
David, can you help us here?
Well, I was going to say you're right. You know, it's bad enough in cultures where, you know, there has been education about the disease of addiction and it hasn't spread. I mean, I was just at a conference at the United Nations and talk about how bad it is here. I mean, in other countries, as one of the, as a representative from the Philippines said, you know, the way we deal with addiction is we execute addicts.
They have Duterte. Yeah, Duterte.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not an exaggeration. But it's true. And again, it's all about education and it's changing slowly. People have to understand. You know, it also has to do with the criminal justice system. I mean, once we understand that people are ill, the last thing we want to do is put them in jail. We want to get them help. And, you know, it's a slow process of change, and we have a long way to go.
And there are, I mean, as a caller suggests, there are real cultural differences and cultural barriers. You think about, for example, fetal alcohol syndrome among Native Americans. It's a terrible problem. It's, you know, a problem that is ongoing, and it has to be addressed within that community as well as by whatever resources they can find. And, Jazzy, I thank you for that call. Here's Chris who writes, I was a school administrator for 10 years and witnessed the demotivational effects of habitual pot smoking on countless students. How can we stop everyone from putting a halo effect around this drug? I'm disappointed in our city leaders for welcoming dispensaries left and right. Well, there's the governmental side of it. There's also, in reading your book, I was thinking about somebody like Snoop Dogg, you know, who's kind of a charismatic character, funny character. People like him and everything. Seems to be cool, chill. Right.
Yeah.
But he smokes a hell of a lot of pot. And, you know, this is appealing to young people.
Yeah. Well, I actually wrote about the fact that, you know, some of the songs make it sound so great and so romantic. And movies do, too. It looks like so much fun. It looks like that is the way you socialize. That we have to counter that, and it's tough. And as far as, you know, this idea of
and
the halo.
And we joke around it. We used to be like joking about Dean Martin's alcoholism, which may or may not have existed, or those other characters who did a lot of drinking. It's the same way with drugs.
Yeah. And this idea that we put a halo over drugs and alcohol, it's really, really something to look at. It's true. And we have to recognize, you know, I have a lot of friends who are very active in the legalization movement, people who very strongly believe in legalization, which I, you know, I support, actually. But we have to make a distinction. I mean, not one of those people, if I ask them, well, do you want your kids using? Of course not. I mean, it's different for teenagers because of the fact that their brains are developing. And you talked about demotivation, and it's absolutely true, and it's been tracked. So we do have to talk differently about this whole issue when we are talking about our kids.
And you were talking before about the possibility of having car accidents from kids who are high, especially even on cannabis. But now, you know, it's recreational drug. It's legal. Yeah. So are we going to have more accidents? There's a lot of mixed data on that.
Well, I think that there is some data that we are. And the other thing, you know, a lot of people will say to me.
They claim in Colorado there haven't been more accidents. I mean, I've had shows on this. So,
well, I was going to say that, you know, people often say, well, it's not as bad as alcohol use. I mean, alcohol, you're much higher. It's much more likely to get in a traffic accident, and that's true. But that doesn't answer this question, you know, what about this? And it does – you know, I've read a lot of research that actually contradicts that and says that, yes, it's twice as likely. I mean, that's the Medit study that looked at a lot of the research says that. So, you know, it's not, I think, whatever it is with alcohol, seven times more likely or something like that, but twice as likely isn't, you know, you don't want your kids driving high.
And we'll bring some more of our callers aboard here. Let me go to you, Betty. Thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I want to say thank you so much for doing this work. It's very, very powerful work, and it can't be easy. And I'm so grateful that you're doing this and reaching out to all these families and kids. My nephew was adopted as an infant. He was drug exposed, started using Oxycontin, then went on to heroin. Unfortunately, he has been in prison twice, treatment programs twice, all have failed. Now he's on the streets. My question is, my family has been bled dry, trying to support him in this, as best we can. But now he's on the streets. We know where he is. We bring him tents, and he's in Chicago, of all places. Anyway, what do you tell a family where they, now the kid's on the streets, no more money for anything? We can't give him any more money to get him into treatment programs. There's nothing available in Chicago. What do you tell us as a family? How should we proceed at this point, which is really rock bottom?
Nick Sheff, you have some wisdom for Betty, particularly since you mentioned before that you're not getting money really helped you finally maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so sorry. It's so frustrating. And, you know, I have a friend actually right now who just relapsed recently. And, you know, having gone through it, I feel like even I still feel frustrated with it. And I just want to shake him and just be like, what are you doing? But, you know, I think, yes, it's absolutely, you know, just it was so important for me to just get the message, like I said, that the only help that I was going to get was help, you know, figuring out how to get into some sort of treatment. And I know that, you know, these programs can be so, you know, expensive. And if someone's not on their, you know, if they're old enough, they don't have insurance, then of course, like, then that's a whole other issue. But there are in every community, and actually I'm sure in Chicago, I don't know specifically, actually maybe my dad knows more about the specific programs, but there are scholarship programs for people on the street. There are county run programs, and the 12-step program, I mean, I know that it doesn't work for everybody, but it is an incredible organization, and they, you know, do help millions of people, and it's, you know, completely free. And, you know, I've seen the way that in my local 12-step community, there are guys that literally, I mean, they devote their lives to helping people stay sober for no profit. And, you know, just for this sort of sheer goodness of helping one addict, you know, helping another. So, you know, that's always a resource that is there. But I don't know, Dad, do you have more like specific, do you know any programs in Chicago specifically?
Well, I wish I did, but, you know, you could even get in touch with me because I have ways to find that out. I mean, I know a lot of people, but in San Francisco, we really are lucky. I mean, it's still hard to get treatment. It's hard to get good treatment. But for instance, St. Anthony's has...
I just read a comment here because it's apropos. Eliza writes, I want these two nice people to recognize their privilege in this struggle. As hard as their journey was, they obviously had access to resources and education that are out of reach for anyone, especially parents who are working class or impoverished. Do they have solutions or ideas to combat the crisis or lack of accessibility to care?
You're right. You're right. It's a disaster. You know, we live in a country that... if you don't have access, it's not just addiction. Mental health care is really hard to access, and it's really even harder to access good mental health care. That's why it's such a fight, you know, and there is a political component now. There are organizations in every city that I visited of parents. Many of them, most of them have started by parents who've lost their kids. They have gone to get banded together to say, you know, what are we going to do so that other families don't have to bury their children? And they are trying to influence policy that good treatment is available. There's no denying, you know, that we're lucky. And I, you know, there's some guilt about that. I mean, there's some survivor's guilt, I think, when I hear from these families who haven't, you know, had the access to get their child into treatment after treatment. And it wasn't easy for us either. You know, we burned through our insurance and ended up paying for some of these programs over 10 years. But we still were able to do that and, you know, to pretend that that's an option for many, many people is, I mean, it's just not, we know that.
Nick, I have a tough question for you. When you talk about education having possibly made a difference, if you've been exposed, for example, to a greater understanding of the kind of stresses you were going through and how you use drugs as an escape, an outlet, a way of alleviating stress, all those kinds of things. Do you really think deep down, because at one point in the book you say, if I think about doing my life over, and of course I can't do my life over, there's no way I can do that, but do you think if you were younger and had learned and had been exposed to those kinds of things, that there was no way you still could have fallen into the traps you fell into?
It's impossible to say, I guess, but
that's why I said it was a hard question. You know, it's impossible.
Yes, yeah, but you know, I think it's totally true that you know it's really hard for young people to sort of open up about the way that they're feeling and even to understand the way that they're feeling, and so that's why you know it's so important as a community that we, you know, are sort of there to help at least try to provide young people with the tools that they need to be able to sort of look at themselves and recognize, you know, the sort of feelings that they have and to sort of be really proactive, you know, not wait for the problems to arise, but to go in and start, you know, education programs to help young people deal with stress.
You're talking about finding agency, really. I mean, I think that's the key here, finding agency within themselves. And I also have to find a little agency to remind you that this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And David, you want to say something here?
First of all, you know, when we talk about helping our kids, can we do that? The San Francisco Public High Schools have these health centers. It was an experimental program for a long time. It basically what it means is that health in high schools in San Francisco, there's a place for people to go if they themselves are struggling or if they know someone is struggling. It's completely, you know, anonymous. No one's going to get in trouble. I mean, those are the kinds of ways that we can help our kids. The thing that I really wanted to say is you mentioned the word before, and I just feel like it's so important that I can't sort of ignore it, which is, you said, tough love as a concept. We hear that over and over again. As soon as I got, you know, into this world, I would go to family groups with Nick, and I kept hearing over and over again, you have to let, you know, your loved one hit bottom. I have to let him hit bottom. You know, in the movie, there's a scene when, you know, Steve Carell, you know, me, weirdly, shuts the door, hangs up on the son, on Nick. And I did that. And I look back and I see that in the movie, and that's the one thing in the movie that really it's so hard for me to watch, because I don't want that to be the message. We were really lucky because I did hang up the phone and Nick then went into treatment. You cannot imagine how many people that write to me and they say, I kept hearing that message, let him hit bottom, close the door, hang up the phone, and I did it.
And so many people can't do it because it's life and death, really. Well, exactly.
And the next call I got was the one that every parent said, my child didn't make it. And one dad wrote to me and he said, you know, was my love tough enough? You know, we don't want to hit people to hit bottom. We want to catch them as soon as we can, because this is a disease. It gets worse. It not only gets worse in terms of the physical toll, but also the life toll, you know, the consequences. You know, you mentioned incarceration, crime. Ending up in the emergency room with a million other problems, accidents. I mean, there's so many other problems. And so we want to try to catch people as quickly as we can, which is not to say it's easy.
No, it's hard, very hard. And here's Oscar joining us. Oscar, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
No problem. Hi. You guys have mentioned using drugs as a way to combat stress. And I was curious if you guys were familiar with Nadine Burke Harris's research.
She's been a guest on the Forum program, actually. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right. So she's the new California Surgeon General. And I'm a grad student right now, and I've been reading her research. And I think it's incredibly appropriate, given what you guys have been talking about for the last 30 minutes or so, regarding stress, and how she talks about toxic stress and drug use as a way to kind of self-medicate this issue of toxic stress in adolescence and whatnot. I was curious if you were familiar with that, especially given that the location, I mean, she practiced in the Bayview and working in California. So
yeah,
I was curious if you were familiar with that.
Do you know her work, David Sheff?
I do.
Nadine
and I guess,
Harris,
yeah, and the big point
it's
there
impressive
is
work, yeah.
Toxic stress is, you know, it's huge. And it's logical. You know, if you've got a child who's growing up and they are in pain for whatever reason, and then they get high and there's some relief of that pain, at least for the moment, you know, if they've got depression, if they've got, you know, hyper anxiety, if they go home and there's, you know, violence in the house, if they go in the streets and there's, you know, drug use and violence, I mean, whatever it is, you know, it makes sense, you know, that if somebody has mental illness, you know, they want to feel better. And so we have to do what we can to try to catch it early. You know, that's one place where parents and teachers and community leaders and therapists, we can all work together, you know, pay attention in a new way, learn, help us learn as parents, as teachers, what to look for. So if you have a child who is suffering, you know, who's isolated, for example, you know, what's the difference between a child with depression and who needs help and somebody who's just maybe shy and just is less, more reticent? Well, we don't know. We're parents. You know, we don't know. A teacher doesn't necessarily know. But that's the time not to, you know, assume that it's okay, but to get some professional help and to try to figure this stuff out, and then to figure out for people who do have this kind of stress, who do have trauma, to get therapy. To, you know, there are things that work, but we have to identify it first.
And let me thank Oscar for the call and get to an important question here from Julie. What do you think is the appropriate age to start speaking to children about addiction? My daughter's family has a long history, and although my child is a toddler, I want her to be prepared to be more aware. Is there an age, David?
I think there's no age too early. I mean, obviously you want to give somebody appropriate information, but kids are, you know, they absorb, you know, Daisy and Jasper, my other kids, Nick's little brother and sister, you know, was, at the time they were so young when Nick became addicted that we assumed that they somehow would be immune, that they didn't understand what was going on. But now we look back and realize that they absorbed it. The best thing we ever did for them is when we finally, you know, decided the one thing I did right, I guess, when they were young and when Nick was going through this in the earlier stages, is realized the stress and got into some family therapy. I think that, you know, there's what are we going to tell our kids? Well, it's got to depend on how old they are, but start the conversation early and keep getting, you know, don't stop having it. It's not a one-time conversation. We learn to listen to our kids so we understand what they're experiencing, what they need to know.
We're going to have to leave it there, but thank you both for coming in, telling your story, and highlighting what you believe is very important. A lot of it, again, is in the book. The book is called High, Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction. Thank you, David Sheff.
I'm Michael. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Nick Sheff.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you both for being with us this hour, and I say that to our listeners. Thank you as well, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.